We think this is a huge issue that will have monumental impacts on the state budget in the years to come.
Americans for Prosperity campaigns against Medicaid expansion in Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, February 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Native leaders question the appearance of two Tlingit masks on Antiques Roadshow.
And of course, when I look at them, I see that they are Tlingit Atu, or, you know, they are sacred clan objects.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Alaska Pacific University now offers the APU Promise Tuition Grant, a program designed to significantly minimize or eliminate out-of-pocket tuition expenses for Pell-eligible students. More at 1-800-272-7528. This message is sponsored by APU.
When Governor Bill Walker was elected, there were questions about the fate of the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project. The proposed $10 billion state-owned gas line was viewed as a backup plan to the large line currently being pursued alongside the North Slope producers. But Walker had criticized the project as being redundant. Now, Walker not only plans to keep the ASAP project alive, he wants to scale up. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
The original Alaska Standalone Pipeline would have been able to transport 500 million cubic feet of natural gas a day. While that sounds like a lot, it's really only enough to service Alaska consumers.
I'm looking at upsizing that.
Governor Bill Walker would like to substantially grow that project, so the state could sell gas to Asian buyers too. It's a change that makes the new version of ASAP look a lot like another gas line project the state is pursuing, the AKLNG project.
We continue with parallel projects, but pretty darn close in size. Envisioning whether it's going to be a 42 or 48 inch line is something to be yet determined.
So if the projects basically look alike and both have the same goal of getting North Slope natural gas to market, what's the difference, and why have both of them in play? The distinction is that as it's currently structured, the state has total ownership of the ASAP line. With the AKLNG line, Alaska has a 25% share at most, with the pipeline company TransCanada getting a cut and the rest of the equity being split by Exxon, ConocoPhillips, and BP. By scaling up the ASAP line instead, Alaska would be positioned to take on majority ownership of a gas line. Walker also describes the new iteration of the project as a backup in case the AKLNG project falls through. He says he did not face opposition from the North Slope producers when he informed them of his plans.
I just couldn't bet on one particular project. It was all in on one particular project. So I didn't really receive any pushback from them on this.
When contacted, spokespersons for Exxon and ConocoPhillips said they were still reviewing the changes to determine what they mean for the project, while a spokesperson for BP referred questions to the governor. But members of legislative leadership are skeptical of Walker's plan. Representative Mike Hawker, an Anchorage Republican, is one of the architects of the bill that created the ASAP project in the first place. Because the project would cost upwards of $45 billion, he says taking on majority ownership creates extra risk for the state, and that the proposal could put the AKLNG line in jeopardy.
The governor has introduced a great deal of uncertainty into my mind as to what the state's intent and mission is, and I know it has introduced that same uncertainty into our business partners' minds.
Representative Craig Johnson, an Anchorage Republican, also has concerns about how the project would work if the producers who control the gas leases are not major players. He says that raises the question of whether Alaska would have an actual product to put on the market and whether it would get a good price for it. His preference would be to partner with the producers rather than the end buyers to get a project built.
I think if you align yourself with buyers, their main mission is to get the lowest price they can possibly get, which that translates into the lowest price for Alaskans. On the other hand, if you're doing producers, they're involved with negotiating the highest price, which means a better price and more money for the state of Alaska.
At a press conference on Thursday, Walker said he did not believe any legislation or additional money was needed to move the ASAP project in a new direction. Legislators are currently reviewing that statement. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The conservative group Americans for Prosperity, backed by the billionaire Koch brothers, recently opened an office in Anchorage. They're working to convince elected officials to support their version of smaller government. And one of their main priorities this legislative session is defeating Medicaid expansion. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Americans for Prosperity opened up its Alaska office in early August to help elect Dan Sullivan to the U.S. Senate. It's one of 34 chapters across the country. And State Director Jeremy Price says the group is here to stay.
This is a long-term effort to promote economic freedom.
The office has four staff members right now, and Price expects that number to grow soon. Stopping Medicaid expansion tops the group's legislative agenda. Americans for Prosperity led a successful campaign to defeat a Medicaid expansion bill in Tennessee this year, even as the state's Republican governor supported it. Price is hoping for the same success in Alaska.
We think this is a huge issue that will have monumental impacts on the state budget in the years to come.
Medicaid expansion would allow low-income, childless adults to have health coverage. It's funded by the federal government at 100% through next year, and then the match rate gradually decreases to 90% in 2020. So far, Americans for Prosperity's campaign against expansion in Alaska has been relatively quiet. The group held a reception at the Baranoff Hotel in Juneau last month, where Fox News contributor Guy Benson made the case against expansion. Price says about 10 lawmakers attended. In Tennessee, the group launched an aggressive radio ad campaign that asked constituents to join the fight against expanding Obamacare. Price won't say if they're planning a similar campaign in Alaska.
I would say all of our tools are on the table, and it'll be a kind of wait-and-see approach. We'll see what happens. You know, we'll take it day by day.
Price says Medicaid expansion may seem like a good deal for the state, but it comes at the expense of taxpayers. He says the state can't afford the program even at the generous federal match rate because Medicaid already eats up too much of the state budget. Price also argues the federal government will abandon its funding commitment. Republican lawmakers hit on all those themes at a legislative hearing on expansion earlier this week. David Guttenberg, a Democrat from Fairbanks, spoke in favor of Medicaid expansion at the hearing. He says Americans for Prosperity is interfering in the rights and health of Alaskans.
Go home. Go back to where you came from. Go back to your billionaire funders. You know, the conservative movement now relies on outside interest, outside think tanks, you know, to tell them what to do and tell them how to think and tell them how to vote. And clearly there's way too much of that.
It's an argument Jeremy Price is defensive about. He grew up in Fairbanks. Two other workers in American for Prosperity's Anchorage office are also from Alaska. Price says 5,000 Alaskans have identified with the group and many are ready to help get the group's message out. He says the mission isn't to convince the public something they don't already believe.
You can't just come into a state, dump a bunch of money in, and expect to have long-term lasting change. That doesn't work. The only way this works is by engaging citizens on a grassroots level, identifying issues that they care about, educating them on the perspective that they may not be hearing, and making sure those opinions and those voices are heard in the assembly, in the state capitol, and in Washington.
Price is planning to return to Juneau when the debate over Medicaid expansion heats up. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaskans react to news that the state ranks number one for well-being.
I wasn't aware that we were even close to being number one, so seeing that was really nice to know.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Doyon Limited announcing the 2015 Board of Directors election, encouraging e-proxy or paper proxy submission no later than Tuesday, March 10th before 5 p.m. Information at doyon.com.
ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, gives Alaska Native students the inspiration and opportunity to excel in science and engineering careers, building a sustainable future for Alaska. More at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
A recent episode of the popular PBS program Antiques Roadshow caught the attention of some Southeast residents when a couple of 200-year-old Tlingit masks from Haines appeared on screen. It sparked the interests of regional natives and historians and raised questions about how the items ended up in the Midwest. KHNS's Margaret Friednauer has the story.
Fans of Antiques Roadshow wait for those moments when an item on the program is valued at tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. The TV cameras catch the owner's stunned reaction when they hear their family heirloom is worth more than they imagined. That's what happened recently during an episode of the show that was filmed in Bismarck, North Dakota. Here's appraiser Tim Trotta giving the news to a guest about a wooden mask.
Would sell in the neighborhood of $175,000. We never see.
Oh my gosh.
Wow.
Oh,
these are among the most rare objects in North America.
Trotta estimated a second mask worth $75,000. But in this case, for some Alaska viewers, the value wasn't the shocker. It was the two items being appraised. They were carved masks in the Tlingit style and, according to the owner, originally from Haines. PBS does not identify guests on the show. We found the owner's name through social media, but have not been able to reach him. He also gave one clue to his identity when he explained to the appraiser where the masks came from.
They date back, I believe, into the 1890s, where my great-grandfather was a missionary to what is now called Haines, Alaska.
Trotta, the appraiser, described the masks as a wolf and a face or guardian mask. He said there is a carving of a raven in the wolf's ears, and abalone was used for the wolf's eyes. He said the guardian mask may depict an ancestor. He pointed out the faint pigments still visible on the wood, and he estimated they date to the 1700s. But local natives and art experts say Trotta got a few details wrong. Those aren't raven figures in the wolf's ears. They're eagles. A wolf and raven would not appear together in Tlingit objects.
And, of course, when I look at them, I see that they are Tlingit Atu, or, you know, they are sacred clan objects.
That's Rosita Worrell, director of Sea Alaska Heritage Institute in Juneau.
And this belongs to the Kagwantan of Haines. You've got a wolf, and you've got that eagle in the ear. And to me, I said, this is, and it's from Haines, so it's got to belong to the Kagwantan there.
Helen Alton, who is the director of the Sheldon Museum in Haines, also watched the episode. She says if the masks are as old as appraised, they would have been kept inside, perhaps in a covered grave. But she says they also appear worn.
What my thought was is that these were used in cultural context. That's the kind of wear that I've seen on stuff that's been used in a cultural context over a long period of time.
That brings up another point. How did the masks make their way into private hands and to North Dakota? The museum did some research and suggests the great-grandfather who acquired the masks was likely Pastor William Walter Warren, who was in Haines in the late 1890s for nearly a decade. It's difficult to say if the pieces were gifted to the pastor or if he collected or bought them. Alton says there are instances of pieces of spiritual value being gifted to missionaries when someone converted to Christianity.
Sometimes it's part of the process of conversion is giving up the old, and so many missionaries acquired things as gifts.
Worrell says if that's the case, the masks illustrate the sometimes troublesome history of missionaries in the Chilkat Valley.
What is I find interesting is the contradictions. The great-grandfather was a missionary and a teacher, and at that time they were teaching Tlingit people that our spiritual beliefs and practices were wrong. But at the same time, he's appropriating Tlingit objects. And I like to quote Joe Hotch from Klukwan, who says, they collected our sins.
Alton sent a letter to PBS this week asking for help in getting in contact with the owner. She suggested the family could gift or lend the masks to the museum so they could care for them and display them in Haines. Worrell says Sea Alaska would also be interested in talking with him, and it's possible they could work with other organizations to purchase the masks if they ever come up for auction. But with the recent appraisal of $250,000 for both masks, that could be an expensive undertaking. Reporting in Haines, I'm Margaret Friednauer.
Gallup today released its annual index of well-being, and for the first time, Alaska tops the list. The researchers who produce the Gallup Healthways report say Alaska residents had the highest well-being in the nation in 2014. The Gallup report doesn't mention that the state has among the highest rates of suicide, sexual assault, and other violence. Nonetheless, APRN's Liz Ruskin found Alaskans working in the social services trenches were inclined to greet news of the report with open arms.
Laura Brown, a spokeswoman for United Way in Anchorage, says by the time she woke up, a friend had already posted the story on her Facebook wall.
It's awesome. I wasn't aware that we were even close to being number one, so seeing that was really nice to know.
She got to work and found the well-being report all over her inbox, and it was the talk of her office. Brown says it was a real shot in the arm, a counterpoint to Alaska's high ratings on all those other national indices: suicide, domestic violence, child abuse, substance abuse.
It's kind of ironic, I think, that we've got both of those things happening at the same time.
The well-being index is based on phone surveys, nearly 177,000 nationwide. We couldn't reach Gallup to ask how many were contacted in Alaska, but their website says the results are weighted to match each state's demographics. They asked about five areas: sense of purpose, financial, social, and physical health, and liking your community. The research director said in media interviews, Alaskans reported the lowest levels of stress, high blood pressure, and drug use. Remember, this is based on telephone surveys. Alaska's also number one for having residents who help to improve their community. The community part rings true to Ann Weaver, a manager at the Fairbanks Community Food Bank.
I'm so excited to hear that because we get to see all the good in this community, and we see it every single day.
Weaver says people hear she works at a food bank and they connect with the suffering. But she's definitely a glass half full type. As Weaver sees it, the food bank gives her an opportunity to witness amazing generosity and to do her own bit for well-being.
You know, we typically serve approximately 150 people each day, and 40% of them are kids. And so I can go home tonight knowing that it made 150 people's day better.
Peter Penny, executive dean for the College of Rural and Community Development at UAF, can't vouch for Gallup's methods or findings. But Penny, who's also president of a Fairbanks Social Services Network, does see how the dark and light of Alaska's well-being can both be true.
Well, certainly we are leaders in lots of bad indicators in certain areas. But overall, depending on who you talk to, it is a state where people do pay attention and look out for each other.
Penny says Alaska has higher than average rates of philanthropy and volunteering, particularly in the social services sector.
So even though we have issues, we have a lot of people working on those issues.
You might think people immersed in that work would be inclined to dismiss a well-being survey that doesn't mention Alaska's serious problems. But suicide prevention trainer Eric Boyer at UAA says he's happy to see it.
If you think about resilience in a community, they need to know that some things that we're doing are good and have some positives.
Boyer says he thinks Gallup did tap into something real about Alaska, but maybe just one side of a dichotomy. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The 2015 PFD filing season is here. If you have questions about your absences or someone you know away at college or serving in the military, the State of Alaska Department of Revenue encourages you to be proactive. Check out the absence guidelines before applying for your PFD. Visit pfd.alaska.gov and click on eligibility in the banner to learn more. The deadline to apply is March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
A rock slide closed the Seward Highway in both directions for about 2 hours this morning. The slide pushed debris and at least one huge boulder onto the highway just before 7 o'clock. State Department of Transportation spokesperson Shannon McCarthy says an SUV hit the boulder, which alerted officials to the incident. McCarthy says local weather conditions could have triggered the slide.
Anything that causes like a freeze-thaw cycle can loosen material.
McCarthy says slides are not unusual in the area just south of Anchorage.
This area from the Potter's Way Station down to about Indian, we do monitor throughout the year, but particularly in the springtime and other times such as like after a seismic event or after high winds for any kind of material that may have become loose and fallen onto the roadway.
Crews cleared the rocks away and the highway opened up by 9 a.m. According to the Anchorage Police Department, there were no injuries reported in the incident. Supporters of the Tenaya Child Development Center today appealed to the University of Alaska Board of Regents, urging the board to help save the daycare center. Tenaya was informed it would need to find a new home late last month, when UAA opted to end an agreement which allowed the child care facility space on campus. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Max Kohlberg is an assistant professor with the WAMI program at UAA and one of several Tenaya parents to testify. Aside from being a faculty member and parent, though, Kohlberg is also a graduate of the program.
All my earliest memories come from Tenaya. I believe my very first memory is sticking my tongue to a yellow metal duck out in the playground and being stuck to that duck howling as the teachers ran to get warm water and pry my mouth from it. I remember nap time, I remember my best friends, I remember my teachers, and I remember trying cottage cheese for the first time.
Kohlberg's 3-year-old daughter attends Tenaya, and he hopes his son will be able to go next year. Kohlberg's desire to keep Tenaya open and on campus echoed that of the other supporters at the meeting. Jo Heckman is the chair of the Board of Regents. She says the board understands it's a sensitive and emotional issue for those affected by the decision.
I myself am a mom, so I understand what displacement does, to people, their work lives, and their ability to function in a work environment.
And Heckman says she also sees it from the university's point of view with the bleak outlook on state funding. Heckman says public testimony is a good opportunity to listen, but ultimately the Tenaya decision is not one the board will be involved in.
Board of Regents will allow the chancellors to run their universities. Otherwise, we would be doing their job, and really I don't think that's the right thing for us to do as a governance body.
Heckman says the scope of the board is to provide oversight and policy to the university system, not to make decisions at the campus level. UAA has created a task force involving university students, staff, and faculty, Tenaya board members, along with nonprofit and early childhood development experts, to help figure out a future for the center. Megan Olson is UAA's Vice Chancellor for University Advancement and a member of the task force. Much of the discussion over the last few weeks has surrounded the issue of space, but she says the group's first task is to define and lay out Tenaya's goals.
Once we define that dream, I think we need to start planning toward that, and then, the space will come.
Olson says the task force hopes to meet weekly. She says the university has also committed $10,000 to help cover Tenaya's rent expenses over the summer. The center has to vacate its space on the UAA campus by May 8th. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Public testimony will continue tomorrow morning at the Board of Regents meeting in Anchorage. The state of Alaska has awarded a grant to the Yukon-Kuskokwim Economic Development Council, or YKEDC, for a truss manufacturing project. If the plan goes forward, local workers would use the region's wood resources to build frames for highly energy-efficient housing. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has more.
If all goes as planned, there'll be a truss manufacturing plant in Bethel supplied by logging operations and sawmills in upriver villages within the next few years. Brent Latham is the Economic and Energy Development Director at the Association of Village Council Presidents, or AVCP, the regional tribal nonprofit that houses the new Yukon-Kuskokwim Economic Development Council, or YKEDC, for which he's also the director. He says the project has the potential to create new jobs in one of the state's most economically depressed regions.
It would be dozens of jobs in
my thinking, especially with the truss manufacturing plant combined with the additional jobs that would be needed to harvest timber and make lumber out of the timber.
The grant of about $70,000 was awarded January 23rd. Half of it was awarded immediately, and the other half will be dispersed after a mid-year report is submitted. The funds are intended to support the truss manufacturing project from assessment and feasibility to implementation. AVCP President Myron Nanning says local manufacturing could have cost advantages for building housing.
Trying to find ways to reduce costs of ordering material from out-of-state sources, and also having some of the supplies here in Bethel that can be shipped to the local area villages.
The goal is to promote regional economic development and improve housing. 40% of housing stock in the region is considered overcrowded, and about 3,000 homes should be replaced. That's according to a feasibility study produced for AVCP by the Cold Climate Housing Research Center and funded by the state of Alaska. Jack Hebert is CEO for the nonprofit that works to develop energy-efficient building technology adapted for the Arctic. He says the plant would supply trusses made from local white spruce for their integrated truss design. Hebert says the design isn't fancy, but it's adaptable and way more energy efficient than the houses that exist in the region now.
Our typical home that's built with this technique, a house that would use a regular framed house, about 1,200 gallons a year in fuel, uses more like 200 gallons of fuel a year. So it's about an 80% reduction in the amount of fuel used.
Hebert says the Cold Climate Housing Research Center has tested the design throughout the state and has two duplexes that use it under construction in Bethel now. Eventually, they'll serve as dormitories for AVCP flight and aircraft maintenance schools. Nolan Clauda with University of Alaska Anchorage's Center for Economic Development is developing business plans for the project. AVCP and YKEDC officials say they still have to secure construction funding and probably won't break ground on the truss plant until 2016. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Daisha Eaton in Bethel. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com. And by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at alaskapublic.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.